It's so much fun to be back here again with Michael. Michael and I have had many, many conversations in the past, but he's been busy with a new job and a wife and a baby, all of which you didn't have when I first met
Yeah.
you. So, anyway, it's a delight to have you here. And recently I was talking to you about a new guy that I discovered named Kirk Durston, who is going to be on the channel in March. And he has many degrees, but they have to do with information, and he's also done some stuff in biology with DNA. And I ran across a clip of his that I just wanted to share real quick, that I thought would give us a jumping off place to start here. And we'll just play a couple minutes of this. He's such a cheerful guy. Whoops. So you can see this, right?
Yeah. Information in DNA ceased to function after only one error was introduced. If we grant that the mind of God was behind the genetic information programmed into the DNA of life, then God designed that information to be copied over and over again and continue to work even in hostile environments where random errors were introduced. Here's my point. The information God programmed into our DNA was designed with maximum flexibility, taking into account real-life challenges such that it could still accomplish its objective generation after generation and with thousands of random errors introduced into the software of life. Now let's compare that to the Bible. As I studied genetics and specialized in the genetic information in genes, it struck me one day that God used the same approach when he inspired the writing of the Bible over a period of 1,500 years. It was designed with three things in mind. First, it was designed to be copied over and over again by humans who will make copying errors and still convey accurate information about God and his desires and plan for humanity. Second, it was designed with the kind of flexibility that would allow it to be translated into all human languages such that people of any language could read it in their own tongue and come to an accurate understanding of what God desired to communicate to us. Third, it was designed with something we call redundancy. And I need to explain what I mean. When a spacecraft is sent to another planet, backup systems are usually built in. In a hostile environment, a critically important component might fail. So one or two backup systems are designed into the spacecraft so that it can keep working millions of miles from Earth and for many years in some cases. The existence of backup systems is often referred to as redundancy. We also see this redundancy in genetic information. Humans, for example, have a minimum of two copies of each gene, so that if one is defective, chances are the other one can supply the required protein. We see brilliant redundancy in the Bible. Now, I know it would be great if when we wanted information about the Trinity or the end of human history or how to grow closer to God, we could simply turn to the one chapter in the Bible that dealt with that particular topic, the way we often design textbooks to work. But what would happen if a particular people group at some point in history didn't have access to that particular section of the Bible, as so often has been the case? One of the amazing things about the Bible is its built-in redundancy. Instead of having everything to do with one topic isolated to just one section, it is distributed throughout the Bible in such a way that one can still find accurate information about that topic, even if they do not have access to the entire Bible. Furthermore, the more important that information is, the more often it seems to be repeated at different locations throughout the Bible.
So we'll just stop there. I could listen for a long time. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's obviously true, and you could sort of say that anything that's lasted through a long period of time has these features in place. Whether it's great architecture, literature, et cetera, there's something at which it's sort of operating at many different levels.
that I think even when we talk about or think about something like beauty, for instance, I think what we're able to perceive as beauty is this sort of all at once-ness of the many levels kind of interacting with each other. So yeah, I think it's a phenomenal insight, and I think it sort of throws a bit of a wrench into our sort of modern understandings of mechanical causality, and this sort of like we have a sort of a over rigorous way of trying to search out how things should work theoretically and so forth. But I don't think really jives with the book of nature as we see it.
Now, this morning as I was walking, I was listening to some kind of scholar talking about Heidegger's essay on the work of art. And he was talking about a lot of different things in there, as Heidegger always does. But one of the things that this guy mentioned was that when we hear a sound, like, for example, the wind whistling in a storm whistling through the chimney of the fireplace, we don't hear a bunch of particles moving that are pushing up against the air, that is pushing up against our ear. That's not what we hear. We hear, oh, there's a storm causing a whistle in my fireplace. That's exactly the thing that Jordan Peterson's always talking about when he says that meaning precedes matter. So you were talking earlier about that things kind of have to get gathered together in order to appear or be revealed. And it's that gathering together that it's the meaning that gathers it together. So without the meaning, there'd be no gathering together.
Yeah. The unity that precedes it.
Yeah.
Which presupposes meaning and purpose prior to this coming together.
Well, and this would be true of all the senses, right? So, I mean, empirical science is supposed to be based on what you can sense, but you're not just sensing photons. You're sensing something comes together for you because of the consciousness that you have. I think it would be, isn't that, wouldn't that be consciousness? I think that's what consciousness is, right? I mean,
yeah.
So, I ran across this word, this Greek word in the scriptures, synaidon, made up of two words, syn and eidon. And the eidon is the kind of seeing that's perceiving, like, oh, I see, you know, I grasp that all of a sudden. And then syn is like a synthesis, bringing together. So the synaidon is basically the apprehending that comes when things gather together. And and I kind of think that maybe was the Greek word that was being used for what we think of today as consciousness, because I know they didn't have a word for consciousness back in the day, right?
Right.
And that made me think of Barfield.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That consciousness is always this gathering together of things. And specifically for human consciousness, it is this interpenetration of both, like the earthly stuff, which goes down into all the nitty gritty details, and then also the sort of unseen elements that for us are really salient, right? Like, because we are meaning seeking creatures, we were looking for that meaning first and foremost. And in fact, that governs whether we see or perceive the thing at all to begin with. Because, you know, I've often heard, you know, consciousness described as really this filtering mechanism, which is, you have like just we looked at all the stuff you could be perceiving at any given moment, at any given time. It's just, you know, this infinite complexity, and yet somehow we don't experience that. Things just appear to us as salient and important and where we focus our attention, you know, and that sort of happens naturally.
So the salience comes from the gathering, is that?
I think it comes from this. I don't know. It's hard to discuss, I think, without getting quickly into ontology, I think that's where sort of modern presuppositions go wrong, is that they have cut off that portion. Like, that portion doesn't exist. Anything sort of unseen that can't be measured with, you know, it in some sense doesn't exist. But where is it coming from? I think there's a fundamental love or care that is this sort of basic substance of reality that allows us to exist at all. And because that precedes us, it brings purpose and meaning to this, to everything that occurs, in such word that we can sort of do this. Now, it's obvious that we, in some sense, like, you know, there's this whole nature nurture thing where, like, we practice certain modes of perception that can really bend or twist us in ways that are better or worse, right? So that, you know, especially like in this area where we have so many extraneous like cultural artifacts of, like, you know, information like social media and so forth that, like, really can, I don't know, sort of grab a hold of our attention in interesting ways. But I don't know where I'm trying to go with that. But I think it is interesting. Like, everything, you either have this problem of infinite regress in terms of trying to understand this, or you have to assume some sort of basic ontology, I think, of love and or, you know, care or something like that, that undergirds everything.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you brought up the whole thing about ontology there, about anything unseen doesn't exist, what really popped into my mind was a couple of days ago, I decided to do a word study of the word idol in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. And in the Old Testament, it's very, very interesting. There's like four or five different words that are translated idol. But one of them is this word Elil, E-L-I-L. And when you look at Elil, it means basically it comes from another word, al, which is the adverb of negation. Mm. And Elil itself means insufficiency or worthlessness or nothingness.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost as though nihilism itself is an idol. And then there is and then of course the word, it's very strange because the word icon in the New Testament is how Christ is described, which is often translated image, but the actual, as near as I can tell, the actual meaning is like likeness.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like an image that can be true or false, but it's a perfect likeness. So it would be like all of the character and attributes and, you know, everything that there is about God. He's the perfect likeness of God. But it got me to thinking that there is some sort of a contrast. Well, and then the other thing was that iniquity is also a word that means non-existence. So iniquity, we think of iniquity being like sin, like being something you did wrong. But iniquity is actually the word that they translate it as iniquity, but the actual meaning behind it is non-existence or non-entity. And so there's something about this that when there is no love, there's no way to bring together, there's no meaning with which to bring things together so that they have entity or that they have existence. So it's all vanity, worthlessness, emptiness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I do think that's sort of the fundamental experience of folks that are caught in nihilism is this, I think, well, I'll just speak from my own experience, but I think in periods of my life where that was kind of the prevailing mode, there was a sort of separateness to all your life where you had like sort of these separate sort of boxes or categories of, you know, interactions, like, you know, like, and there wasn't any sort of meaningful communication between those things, like to kind of pull them up into a whole. And so there's this sort of fundamental arbitrariness to everything, you know, whether you choose to pretend that this little box has meaning or this one doesn't. But it's tremendously I think cognitively, like it's like you're kind of in an overload, because you sort of feel this need to try and produce or fabricate some sort of meaningful structure, where you have this built-in sort of skepticism that's even real. So it's like you're always sort of fighting yourself, because you at your most fundamental level desire meaning, but you don't believe that that's really a thing, you know. That or that if you do, it's you sort of indulging in a sort of self-delusional kind.
And I think that partly happens because of taking apart, dividing, separating. Like if I think of Durston's video, and he's talking about the way that the Bible has all these connections all the way through it. So earlier in the video, he said when he was a child, starting from the age of 8, he'd read the Bible every day, like 15 or 20 minutes every day, but he didn't have any sort of pattern. He'd just pick up a passage and read it. Still, over 10 years of reading every day, he got a pretty good picture of the wholeness of what the Bible is about, even though there were a lot of chapters he never read. And maybe even had been whole books he never read, but he still got pretty much the whole picture. Then when he was 18, he started reading through the Bible every year as a whole. And of course, then you get even more of the wholeness. But it is possible, because the Bible has so many connections built into it and so much redundancy, that it is possible, even without reading the whole thing, to get the basic picture. But kind of what they do with systematic theology is that they make that book he was talking about, where they separate everything out into this piece and that piece and make all these silos in the Bible, you know, so then you end up with all these divisions of denominations, because this division takes that particular piece of the system and they cling to that, and another one takes this piece of the system. But it's not meant to be all these little silos. There's meant to be all these interconnections, which is the same way that our consciousness works, with all these interconnections of ideas. And so when we hear a sound, it could be, there are a lot of different things it could be, but what pops into our mind is all these alternatives that are part of that connecting system. And then we figure out what it is. We don't figure out what it is based on the particles. And I think that's true even of any scientific endeavor. There has to be this synthesizing of our experience and our understanding and all of the categories that we inhabit in order to come to these conclusions.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And, you know, what I was referring to earlier in terms of like these sort of separations, it does leave to that kind of negation that you were referring to in the underlying word structure there for what these idols end up doing. I think the big difference between an idol and icon is the idol is sort of something that it's an end in itself. So like it stops, like you treat the thing as that's all there is, rather than seeing what it's meant to illuminate behind it, right? So like which again you mentioned, you know, Christ as the likeness of God, and that's really what he talks about in the Gospels, is a sort of desire to like his mission overall is to make the invisible visible in finite form, you know, to represent the Father, you know, in real space and time. And I think that's sort of the fundamental lens for understanding what he was doing while he was here, and including what he does on the cross as well. It's a finite representation of something that's infinite. But when we stop at the finite thing and lose a sense of the connectedness or the lensing or the imaging of something larger and infinite and invisible, that's when the icon becomes the idol.
Yeah, I mean, what you just said, like fireworks went off in my head when you mentioned that often when we think of Christ being the likeness of the Father, we think of observing his life and observing what he did and what he said in, you know, telling the parables and interacting with the apostles and with the people that he healed. But we don't very often think that the cross itself, that his experience on the cross is also a likeness of what God is accomplishing through eternity. And a finite representation of the infinite. That's very powerful, very powerful.
Yeah. And it's sort of the boat we're always in. Like there's a sense in which all of our endeavors are always a grasping. It's always a sort of a representation of the finite longing for the infinite. But because we're so limited in as creatures, we tend to sort of have these sort of artificial cutoff points where we can only fit so much into our, consciousness or whatever the computational limits of what we have available to us, and so we create these sort of arbitrary bounds, especially really smart people do this, I think, more than anything is, and we feel this sense of having drawn the perfect map of reality, you know, that we now have the model that suffices, you know. I think historically it's just always wrong. It doesn't matter you know, how smart you are. The smarter you are in a certain sense, the more capacity you have to fool yourself with these sorts of things, and to more to wave off defend your model to the point where you can't really see what's in front of your nose. You know, I always think of somebody like Sam Harris. He always he's obviously so intelligent, but it's like you'll see him in certain conversations where you know, especially the ones with Peterson, where he just clearly can't understand what's being said to him. Like he's just gotten so good at his own rhetorical defenses of his modes of thinking that he's in his own little prison of thought.
And I think it ties into this idea of insufficiency, because the map of reality, I was thinking about this the other day because I was listening to one of Ian McGilchrist's recent lectures, and he was kind of drawing a picture of the two hemispheres of the brain in a way that was a little bit different than he has in the past. And so this thought came into my mind. This is not what he said, but it's a thought that came into my mind, and I could easily be wrong, but the thought that came into my mind is that the left hemisphere is good at quantifying what has occurred in the past and creating a map with it. The right hemisphere is good at being aware of what is happening right now and intuiting what might happen in the future, because the right hemisphere is the kind of attention that can take in the environment to tell whether or not there are opportunities or whether or not there are dangers to be seen. Right. So that's the now and the what's to come. But the left hemisphere needs a map of what has been solidified so far, what it has already occurred, so that it can use that map to create things, to manipulate, and you know, it's very useful. But you have to also have the right hemisphere's picture of the now, because the now is occurring, and there are anomalies that occur in the now that you have to be aware of. If you're not aware of the anomalies or what might happen, then the map of reality is going to always be wrong. So if you're satisfied with the map of reality, you are satisfied with that which is not sufficient. And, you know, there's a verse in the Old Testament, which I can't remember right now, but the basic idea of it is, why do you buy bread that does not satisfy?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, as you're saying that, it made me think of the longer, not the clip you shared of what's the scientist's name again? I forgot.
Durston.
Yeah. So you'd shared a longer clip where he talked about sort of how he was listening to some geologists having an argumentation about, like, they were out in the field looking at, you know, rock sediments and so forth, and coming up to, you know, very all, you know, people that were PhDs and esteemed in the field in the subject, and coming to radically different conclusions about what the physical evidence was showing them. And he said that was kind of a tipping point for him, realizing that there are certain types of science that are much more speculative in terms of their motion, so that they are by their very nature tend to lean towards the abstract and the sort of like mental models and sort of all these kind of circular reasoning that doesn't have this sort of robustness of what we think of science in terms of, like, you know, having very precise measurements of, like, say, like, if I drop this ball, we know that the mathematical model for, like, what gravitational forces are going to exert on it. And, like, we can do that over and over again. We can get even, you know, more decimal places, precision over time in terms of how we do that, which it's just not the same. And I think when we're embodied in real situations, we're always bumping up against reality in ways that is a constant, like, stick in your side, reminding you that your mental model is insufficient, and it pulls you into the now, right? Like, and this happens in little and small ways all the time. And especially in social situations, working with other, you know, interacting with other people, like, you think you have this model of, you know, somebody you know really well, like your husband or your wife, and, you know, then they do something that surprises you, and you suddenly realize that you have to update that model, or that model is not the person. Because you can, especially if you're smarter, you can build a sort of sophisticated model of, you know, your partner and think you know what's going on, and then realize you don't. But I do think that we do live in a time where we get into a lot of these more speculative, abstract modes of perception, where it's, you know, it's it just really lends itself to this sort of prison of thought where there is no cashing out of an embodied experiment or something where the reality gets to poke its head in and say, hey, you're wrong. And so I guess when I'm, I mean, I have this issue in my day job as well all the time because it's funny, people, you get in situations, everybody, to try and understand the complexities of digital technology, people also come up with all these sort of mental models to explain what's going on, or even trying to project in the future. Okay, we do things this way now, but this would make more sense into the future. And like, this will help solve customers' problems by doing it this way. I'm always looking in the back of my mind for like, okay, well, that sounds great. I love your story, but like, do we have an example of like somebody who's doing that at a very, like a large customer that's actually deployed that and it works for them? Like, because I a lot of times I just I know the tendency of really smart people to like, sell themselves on their own story. And it's entertaining, and you have, amazing PowerPoint slides, it sells good, but the rubber meets the road when it's actually in operation and you're actually doing something with it. Then you really, all the real life cost of doing the thing show up.
Yeah, the real life cost. That's a very interesting thought. So let me stretch us a little bit because that for some reason that makes me think of the whole issue of flexibility, which was one of the other things that came to my mind when I was listening to Durston talk, is that having this redundancy built in permits a lot of flexibility. It permits, well, one of the other examples he gave that was not in the clip was that when you build a piece of machinery that has to interact with the real world, like a Jeep that's going to go through the wilderness and through muddy valleys and through rivers and all of that kind of thing, you can't build it to perfect specification because if there's no leeway in the specifications, there's no room for these anomalies to happen. So if it's too rigid, the thing just falls apart the first time it hits a speck of dust. So that means that these flexibilities have to be built into a system in order to keep it functional when it's going through anomalies. And that makes me think about free will. What that basically means is that free will is essential for the universe to function. And I think that free will has to probably go all the way down, which probably sounds a little
It's
crazy.
super interesting. So you're thinking there is that it's sort of a decentralization of
Yes, that choice has to exist at every level for the system to survive. Because, I mean, just like the story about the federal, was it you, not UPS, but Federal Express, is that FedEx? Yeah, the FedEx guy that was confronted with a client that they had guaranteed that they would get the product at a certain time and the roads were closed, and so he went out at the cost of $75,000 and rented a helicopter to get this
Hello.
$50 package delivered. And instead of getting fired, he got a raise because he looked outside the box and he found a solution to an anomaly, because FedEx's guarantee was one of their important principles that they lived on. Now, it's probably a urban legend, I don't know, but it's a story that used to be told in a lot of leadership conferences on what it means to drive the responsibility and the accountability and the opportunity down to the lowest level. And I think that there's something about the way the universe works that there has to be choice at every level in order to manage anomaly, because anomaly is always occurring somewhere.
Yeah.
Now, I know you have a hard stop coming up, so maybe we want to have another time in the future when we can talk about that issue of choice and flexibility and free will and determinism and all of that.
Yeah, I would love to. I think you probably know that's kind of a hobby horse of mine, figuring out or thinking through how does that agency, that free will, interact with the agency and will above us, like in a hierarchical faction, all the way up to the top and all the way to the bottom. So yeah, definitely an interest specifically of mine.
Well, I do think that what you said earlier about love has to be involved there. I don't know if you heard the conversation that I had on my channel with DC Schindler and Ian McGilchrist, when the conclusion we came to is that everything arises out of love. And so love has to somehow be involved in that issue of free will and agency and where it occurs in in the organization or the system of the universe.
I think Schindler argues pretty convincingly in his books that love is a sort of fundamental component of ontologies. It's pretty compelling.
Well, I was surprised that McGilchrist agreed with him, because now McGilchrist is not I think he is a theist of some sort at this point. Time his thinking has been shifting, but I don't know exactly what kind of theist. But the idea that he would recognize that love has to be at the bottom of everything, I thought was pretty interesting.
And I, you know, if to bring Barfield back in, he always said that at some point, we wouldn't be able to do science anymore without making explicit reference to Christ. And I think what that is again, at some point we're going to have explicit reference to that relationship between the finite and the infinite. We'll have to come back into our perceptual awareness to make real progress.
Could you point me to where that quote is?
I have to look it up. I've got so many of his books in my head. I could take a guess.
I'd appreciate that, because I would like to read that. I would like to read that book, whatever that is. You know, yeah. I mean, the only one I've read. Well, I read Saving the Appearances, but
yeah.
But by the time I get to the end of it, I can't understand the beginning of it anymore.
Yeah.
I read Speaker's Meaning, and I have a pretty good grasp of the whole argument in Speaker's Meaning. So, that would be great. And if we can get together again sometime in the next month or so for another half hour, that would be terrific. I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy work day.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to do that. And it's been great seeing you and chatting again.
Okay. Have a great day. Thank you, Michael.
Take care, Karen.